Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. Today I will be starting Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. Hannah Holmes is a Maine resident whose science and travel writing has appeared in publications including the New York Times Magazine, Outside, Sierra, and the Los Angeles Times Magazine. A review of this book in USA Today is quoted as saying, "Witty environmentalists are as rare as shy politicians, but in Suburban Safari, Hannah Holmes laughs at herself while celebrating the wild kingdom she explores. Holmes is a science writer who doesn't lecture. She shares the joy of discovery." So with that as an introduction, we will begin Suburban Safari, and this is dedicated in memory of Cheeky. Introduction. I grew up in a clan that disdained suburbs and cities. We were country folk. Our kind milked our own cow, boiled maple sap from our own trees, and raised pet robins and seagulls from eggs. We pitied city dwellers, who in the summer occasionally pulled into our driveway and pleaded with us to show their children how the carrots grew right out of the dirt. We were immodest about our ability to take care of ourselves in nature. But for me, going to school smelling of cow dung wore thin. I rebelled, running headlong for the city. For many years, I grew not one mouthful of food, nor even a rose. In the park, I didn't know one tree from the next. I forgot the names of birds. And one day, reading in my office at an environmental magazine, I stumbled on a quiz. "Name 5 resident and 5 migratory birds in your area," the quiz prodded. "What direction do your winter storms come from? When is the next full moon? Exactly how far have you fallen, young lady?" I had fallen far, far, and my ignorance of the animals and plants who share the planet has been on my conscience ever since. But for me, the answer was not to get back to the land. There is no land that I could justifiably get back to. Every new house lot displaces a family of woodpeckers or a raccoon, or a tree that has invested 2 centuries in its climb toward sunlight. No, I had already concluded that the salvation of what little nature is left on earth will depend on people staying in the cities and towns. And in the interest of full disclosure, I could never go back to life removed from art galleries and top-shelf baking chocolate anyway. As it happened, I recently settled on 2/10 of an acre near the ocean in South Portland, Maine. Having spent a number of years writing about the natural wonders in such exotic locales as Madagascar and Mongolia, I thought it only fair to approach my new backyard with the same sense of discovery. Just because an organism is local doesn't mean it's simple. My oak tree, for instance, has the ability to adjust its acorn production to manipulate the squirrel population. And that an organism is common doesn't mean it's unremarkable. The ubiquitous groundhog can spend 9 months of the year in hibernation without eating or drinking. But where this book is concerned, I could have plonked myself down any old place. The creatures I befriended, and the dramas of competition, mating, and dying that unfolded before me, are available all around us, all the time. Nature, oblivious to the edict that cities are for people, is carrying on with her business almost as though we don't exist. Ultimately, my reason for spending a year in the yard was not to acquire knowledge for knowledge's sake, although that's plenty amusing. Rather, it was to learn how to administer this patch of ground in the best interest of all its citizens, the chipmunks and the Baltimore Orioles, the skunks, and even the humble mosses. In a world where humanity has climbed into the position of biological boss, I aim to become a benevolent dictator. But I can only rule fairly if I'm familiar with the needs and aversions of all my subjects. As it turns out, taking care of nature is a skill quite different from taking care of myself in nature. That, in hindsight, was simple. Trying to balance the needs of all the organisms in my yard, myself included, is complicated. Everything is connected, for better or worse. Every step of my foot affects my neighbors. My smallest decision, to mow the grass weekly or biweekly, to cut down a tree, to fill the bird bath, rocks their world. When I trap mice in my cellar, I reduce the food supply to any owls who might contemplate making my yard their home. Feeding the local crow family allows me to observe their behavior and know them better, but it tilts their diet out of the natural range, perhaps shortening their lives. If I trim back the invasive bittersweet vines to make room for native sumac trees, the moss loses its shade and turns brown. After a year in the yard, I can see that after a lifetime in the yard, I would still be insufficiently trained to administer this 2/10 acre empire. But you have to start somewhere. The book. I chose to spend a year immersed in the lives of my outback neighbors because it's a neat round of time. With the exception of my own breed, all the species who live here order their lives around the changing seasons. The plants blossom as the insects emerge from winter suspension to pollinate them. Migratory birds move north in synchrony with the emerging insects, fueling up on fresh meat wherever they stop. Squirrel mothers gestate through the hungry months of late winter so that their young will have time to stash away acorns before the snow flies again. In the fruiting season, the crows use the bonanza of calories to grow fresh feathers that will see them through the insults of winter. In the short days of autumn, even the trees alter their cells in preparation for the freeze. To my breed, which can purchase corn on the cob at any time of the year, the seasons have lost some relevance. But to the crowd out back, the strengthening of the springtime sunlight, the ripening of late summer berries, retain a life and death importance. Because nature still observes springtime as the season of new beginnings, that is where I began my observations as well. The scope of my investigation proved to be far too broad for a single soul to cover, so whenever I could, I enticed scientists, scholars of bugs, mice, or even weeds, to come by and shine the light of their expertise on my yard. This was an honor and a pleasure along the lines of Julia Child, James Beard, and Emeril dropping in to cook me dinner. To see my yard through such experienced eyes was akin to peeking through X-ray glasses. My lawn. What's a suburb? The word seems to mean something different to everyone. When I lived in a 3-apartment brownstone in Brooklyn, New York, I felt as though I was in the suburbs of Manhattan. Now, in my neighborhood of 10th-acre lots, I feel 10 times more suburban. Yet, to many minds, such a neighborhood is decidedly urban. And the 5-acre and 10-acre lots farther from town constitute the real suburbs. It's a moot point, really. If you define a neighborhood by the types of wildlife who make a living there, then large and small lots have much in common. Such large lot creatures as moose, coyotes, and black bears take the occasional pass through my small lot neighborhood. Even in the heart of the big city of Portland, a mile north of my yard, many of the same creatures who inhabit my yard earn their daily bread in the streets and trees. Raccoons, squirrels, mockingbirds, skunks, mice, hawks, and oodles of insects. Recently, Portland police shot a moose who had roamed into the thick of things and was unlikely to roam back out without causing vehicular mayhem. Nature has never shown much regard for the lines we people draw on maps. Nature goes where nature can. I am surprised by the amount of nature that exploits my yard. I had been led to believe that lawns are the abomination of the natural world. And perhaps this is so on the ideal lawn. The American lawn, as promoted by the lawn care industry, is essentially a chemically supported grass farm. The plants themselves, lawn grasses, are not native to North America. They need more water than nature provides in most parts of this continent. They're attacked by a plethora of insects, who must then be poisoned. Their ranks are also invaded by other plants, which engenders further chemical warfare. And unless they're mowed regularly, grass plants go to seed and turn brown. The resulting grass farm is pretty to look at, and fun to do somersaults upon, but it's not terribly welcoming to nature. Even the occasional insect who can survive pesticides may not be able to make a living on grass. Many insects are particular about which plants they'll eat. And where insects are missing from the landscape, other animals will be too. Fortuitously, most yards also host some shrubs and trees. This is the mixture that makes nature happy. From a bug's eye perspective, or a bird's eye view, most yards present a rich array of opportunities. There's a prairie of lawn, a savanna of shrubs, and a forest of trees, all within a few flaps of the wing. Many animals thrive on this patchwork of habitats, many more than I would have guessed before I delved into this world. Two important features set my own yard apart from the grass farm ideal. One is it gets no chemicals. This results in a vibrant community of soil organisms and insects. That, in turn, attracts a community of insect-eating birds and beasts and a great diversity of plants. Which brings me to the other feature. My lawn is not pure grass. It's a self-assembled community of grasses and weeds who can survive having their heads whacked off by the lawnmower every week or two. This diverse food supply also contributes to a diverse insect population, which attracts other animals. A less important feature of my lawn is that it's twice as long as the neighborhood average, comprising 2/10-acre house lots. Other than that, it's a typical American lawn. It has a few flower beds, some ornamental shrubs, an oak tree, a couple of pines, a choke cherry tree, and some sumacs. Three craggy apple trees and a few stumps give evidence of the land's prior use, before my 1917 bungalow was built. The lawn is fenced with a haphazard array of pickets, galvanized fence, and rusty wire, but this doesn't seem to limit the traffic of skunks, possums, and other mid-size animals. On one side, my yard is bounded by a neglected lot, which has been conquered by two invasive plants. Japanese knotweed, also known as bamboo, and Asiatic bittersweet. On the other side lies a neatly mown lawn and the continuation of the old orchard. When I began paying attention to the yard, I discovered a vast assortment of neighbors who had been flying under the radar, so to speak. Many town-dwelling animals are nocturnal, which had minimized my overlap with them. Others are subtle, such as the hawk, who killed and consumed a bird in the yard one day. Had I not seen the split second of arrival, I'd have missed the whole thing. And still others are so familiar that they had become invisible to me. On close examination, the squirrels and crows proved to be individual characters, each with a distinct personality, and all busy with work and play in my yard every day. It was heartening to find so much natural activity in such a peopled environment, and it was a pleasure to make the acquaintance of so many citizens in my domain. The good news isn't unvarnished. Not every animal thrills to the sound of the lawnmower. That's unfortunate, because new lawn is rolling out over the United States at a rate of 1 million acres a year. And even if all those acres were plugged full of a diversity of plants, and even if they were kept free of chemicals, some animals simply cannot adapt to life on the patchwork habitat we create. For instance, one of the marvels in my yard is the warbler migration that comes through in the spring. Warblers seem such treasures because they're fleeting, just resting here a day or two. They can only nest and raise a family when they reach a wilder habitat. Every year in my area and across North America, these birds have to fly longer and harder to find their niche. An even more daunting challenge faces a rare plant when its wild home is flattened. Unlike birds, plants don't have the option of flying onward, and plants are the anchors that hold down a food chain. Besides erasing habitat and disrupting the food chain, new lawns also beget more lawnmower fumes in the air, more pesticides in the water, and more traffic on the roads as people travel between their grass farm and their work. So the spreading of the lawn is a problem. The solution? Simply put, packing people into towns leaves more acres for wildlife and exposes fewer acres to our human clutter. The very happy news is that we who crave greenery can find our solace on a fairly small patch of ground. From the core of the city to the edge of the forest, nature is busy eating, growing, fighting, reproducing, dying. Absorbing the drama is the easiest thing to do on earth. All it takes is a lawn chair and a closer look. Spring. Chapter 1. A Flood of Feathers. I've only been investigating my backyard for a few weeks, and already much of what I've seen is weird. The other day I discovered a strip of mummified squirrel skin jammed in the crotch of a sumac shrub. A few weeks ago I found an English sparrow crammed head first into a tangle of forsythia branches, killer unknown. Today, April Fool's Day no less, crows are flying around wearing mustaches. When I dedicated a year to watching my backyard, I suspected the average lawn hosts more activity than meets a casual glance. But I didn't expect to find stashed carcasses, or to witness tail pulling, or pair parties. And that's just the crows. Before long, the squirrels will prove just as wacky. Trees even will amaze me, due to the spite they direct at their enemies. But for now, it's the crows who have captured my interest. They're big, they're bold, and every time I settle in the yard, they do something bizarre. Today, it's the mustaches. The effect is created by many strips of maroon material draped in their beaks. Are they collecting something to make a nest? I doubt it. For one thing, there are four of them, and birds' nests in pairs. Secondly, a crow's nest is a sink-sized mess of sticks, not a drapey maroon basket. As I'm pondering this, four crows without mustaches sail out of the sky and land on the grapevines that climb into my oak tree. Bracing their feet, they peck and pull off strips of peeling grape bark. When each has accumulated a mustache's worth, they all clamber forth from the vines and fly east. Later in the day, a solo crow lands on the brown grass of my lawn and beaks up a wedge of cold soil. She casts it aside and beaks up another. No good. She moves to my north neighbor's yard and continues. In short order, I'm obsessed with my crows. I study their black faces through the binoculars as they swagger around the back of my lawn, prospecting for worms. After a few days of watching them, I can recognize each by its signature caw. If they're checking in with each other, one always says, "Caw, caw, caw." Another says, "Caw, caw, caw, caw." The third bobs slightly and says, "Caw, caw, caw." The last says, "Caw, caw, caw." In other parts of town, the crows I hear start to sound odd, foreign. Reading about crows, I soon find Kevin McGowan, a Cornell ornithologist. At his website, I learn about a crow's favorite nest-lining material, maroon-colored grapevine bark. I learn what crows use to bind the sticks of their nest, gooey soil. I discover that my four crows are a family unit, composed of a breeding pair and two grown children, and I learned that this is my very own family of crows, or rather, that I'm one of their people. Each family of crows owns a bunch of blocks. My lawn may have been in their family for generations. We share a neighborhood, these crows and I. When I read that the West Nile virus is once again killing the crows of New York, it requires some effort to adopt a cool attitude of scientific curiosity. How interesting if West Nile should kill my crows. There are plenty of crows in the world, after all, especially in the suburbs, especially in the past few decades. If crows took their time cozying up to people, that's because our relationship with them was nasty for so long. For centuries, crows filched grain and other food from people, and people responded with birdshot. Crows were slow to forget, but they're naturally adaptable. After it became a no-no to discharge firearms in the suburbs, the crows poked their heads in, and they saw paradise. Lawns seething with worms, copious compost and garbage, and lighted parks and parking lots for sleeping. In the nightmares of crows, I learn on McGowan's site, silent owls drop out of the blackness. They bite the heads off crows and swallow their warm breast meat. Crows like to sleep with the nightlight on. And so the crows have come, and they have multiplied. A few weeks after the grapevine episode, my crows cease eating the worms they pull from the lawn. Instead, they carry them east. I follow. I'm looking for pine trees, based on two pieces of homemade data. One, in the top of my neighbor's 50-foot white pine, is a previous year's nest, shedding sticks. Two, the deciduous trees in the neighborhood are still puffs of green and pink, showing only nubbins of this year's leaves. I imagine a clever bird would choose the shelter and secrecy of an evergreen. In a quiet lane, a father and daughter bounce a ball. Across the road stands a row of pines. When I ask if they've seen crows in the trees, Dad says, "All the time." I squint into the treetops, seeing nothing. Then a seagull drifts near the pines, and a crow emerges. He strikes out after a seagull, muttering in flight. The gull lazily evades and drifts back for another peek at the nest. The crow flaps beside the gull, holding it at a distance. Three more seagulls spiral in. The crow flaps harder, like a cutting horse. He wheels and chases, muttering. The seagulls slide away on the wind. The nest from which the crow bolted is motionless, except for the tossing of the wind. When I look away from it, I have a hard time finding it again. That's what the parents were aiming for. If a raccoon or seagull gets to their eggs or hatchlings, they'll have to choose a new tree, build a new nest, and start incubating all over again. It's a tough business. Fewer than half of crow couples succeed in raising children in any given year. I've been watching the nest for half an hour before I spot a lone crow in a tree 100 feet from the nest. After a few minutes, she moves to another tree, then another. In the coming days, as I visit the nest, I'll find that crows take this sentry job seriously. One or two usually stand watch near the nest. When the family goes worming together, one remains in a tree, surveying the scene. My admiration for crow intellect will grow, too, as I watch them. School children walking home past the nest are no cause for cause from a sentry, but I, pointing my binoculars at the nest, certainly am. Sometimes a sentry sneaks up behind me and sits overhead. Then if Pa Crow flies toward the nest carrying food for Ma Crow, the sentry above me barks the heads-up call, "Cut, cut, 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 cut." Pa Crow veers off and lands elsewhere. But even with my meddling, the crows have it easy. The suburbs are so bountiful that a family of town crows can make a living in a territory one-half or even one-third the size needed by their country cousins. When I tear my attention from the crows, I learn that the suburbs are just as welcoming to many other birds, with a variety of landscapes offering shelter, food, and nest sites, and with people supplementing food and water. Many bird species are content to share space with people. Bird surveys confirm this over and over. To find the greatest number of birds, get yourself out of the woods and into the suburbs. Mind you, on close inspection, the bird bonanza may not feature your favorite species. For instance, one way scientists measure birdiness is in biomass, which is pounds of life per square mile. When you measure birds in tons, they prove to be rare in rural areas, more plentiful in the suburbs, and thickest in the heart of the city. But biomass isn't necessarily beautiful. Most of that downtown bird bonus comes in the form of hefty pigeons. The situation in the suburbs is similar. Although the suburbs attract many species, native birds are underrepresented. Plentiful are European starlings, English sparrows, also known as house sparrows, and those natives like cowbirds, cardinals, and chickadees, who can make a living in the mowed grass and shade tree ecosystem we've invented. Absent, normally, are those indigenous birds that need a deep forest, a tall grass field, or a babbling brook. Just at the moment, though, abnormality is in fine feather. A wave of plumage is breaking over the northern half of the entire continent. On their way to summer breeding grounds, birds of all stripes are pausing in my yard to tank up on the spring flush of insects, weed seeds, and nectar. In May, when my quince bush is a cloud of red blossoms, I sit on the porch each morning waiting for the hummingbirds to arrive. One bright day, they do. Ruby-throated hummers, they sway and glisten like drops of heavy liquid. The male's red bibs blaze in the sun. Hummingbirds schedule their northerly migration to coincide with the opening of gas stations. In February, they buzz away from their winter homes in the Caribbean and Central America. Some fly as far as 500 miles in one shot, crossing the Gulf of Mexico. Others follow the land. Whenever they can, they embed themselves in a south-to-north wave of awakening flowers. They arrive at my quince when it's in full bloom. Now they can visit many of their daily 500 to 1,000 flowers without wasting gas commuting from one bush to another. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We are reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.